evening, everyone. I'm going to call the April meeting of Water Rights Advisory Council to order. Thank you all for coming. We appreciate your service here. And we're going to begin with the public comment period. Is there anyone here for public comment? No?
Apparently not.
We'll move on to approval of the agenda. And we'll, unless there are objections, we'll consider the agenda approved. Objections or corrections? Okay, the agenda is approved. Approval of past meeting minutes.
Have not been circulated, so.
Not circulated? Okay, I was going to say I'll leave it here.
I'm sorry, I was out for most of last week, so I apologize.
Okay, we'll do them next month. And we are now at the presentation item, and Mr. Henry hasn't arrived yet, so we'll move down to questions and comments on RAC chair and AAC chair reports. We received the RAC chair report. Patrick, do you have anything to add?
I think the only thing of substance really in my report was that we feel that the Metro Access option year should be exercised this year, as I indicated. That's up for renewal January, July 1st, and by all accounts, we had Carol Kissel talking to us. It looks like they will exercise that option, so we will have 2 years in which to work with the next contract to see what we can do as far as putting a paratransit contract in place that will improve service from what we have now and take the best of what we have as far as best practices and put them into effect. So I think that's an important piece that I certainly can share with the RAC, particularly since the RAC does have certain areas of interest with the Metro Access. And what we want to do is put together a working group so that we can look at issues and what should be maybe brought in-house or what other systems are doing. Share that with WMATA and make sure that 2 years from now we have a good product.
Great. Thank you, Pat.
Thank you.
Any questions or comments on either of the reports? Penny?
I have a question for Patrick. You're referring to the contract with MTM?
As contract was?
The contract with MTM, that's up for me.
MTM?
Yeah.
MB?
Sorry.
MB?
Oh, MB. Do I have
MTM? Do I have MB? Oh, okay, MB. MB. Yes.
Sorry, am I missing?
Okay. That they're exercising the last option of their contract, and the option is for 2 years. So we think that we can, as a committee, be able to give WMATA good feedback as to what should be in the next contract and talk about the good, bad, and the ugly as to what we've seen in this contract and see if we can come up with a better product. What we were concerned with was we had heard that there was a possibility, and I guess it could still occur, that WMATA would choose not to exercise the next option, which means we would have to get a contract, a new contractor in place, and the transition done by July 1st. That's just, I don't see that happening. And that's one of the things that we expressed to Carol Kissel.
I guess a follow-up question. I understand that they have the largest share of the paratransit contracts.
Right.
And one recommendation that previously came out of COG and also the Access for All Committee was to explore maybe not having so much of the contract be with one provider to increase competition and perhaps to make the service more efficient in terms of affordability. Is that something that the committee has looked at?
Yeah, I definitely think that that's an issue that needs to be looked at. I know that there was a report that came out regarding the base contract and what MB was getting as far as payment. I also know that there are probably two or three or four other contractors who could do this particular job that have the resources to do that. That's something we look at. The question then becomes, how do you want the service configured? what parts of the service, if any, do you want to bring in-house? If you bring these service, part of these services in-house, what are the repercussions and that whole sort of thing? So there are a lot of things to look at. How can you increase efficiency, cut costs, retain the service, retain good service?
Right.
We've got 2 years now to look at that, and that's going to give us sufficient time, I think, to do that. And one of the things that we want to do from a procurement standpoint is to put out a request for information, put out some standards, technical requirements, and see what the three or four vendors who probably will be bidding on this will come back with and evaluate that. So we've got some work to do. We also need to know from WMATA what they want to do as far as how much participation can my committee give as far as information and contributions when it comes to something that's a WMATA procurement. So they'll have some very finalized that we need to follow.
Okay, we'll move on to, we'll move back to item number five. The representative is here, and I think he's ready. Mr. Hamry. No stranger to the rack, Mr. Jim Hamry, who's the head of bus operations here at WMATA. He's going to give us a presentation on service levels and standards. Thank you for having me.
Well, good evening, everyone. Yes, that works better. Good evening, everyone. It's a pleasure to visit with you in our annual quest to find a budget somewhere out there. And a couple of purposes to tonight's meeting or presentation. One is to share with you the performance guidelines that we use in assessing Metrobus services. This was a topic that came up at a board meeting last month, and Mr. Downs, I believe it was, particularly wanted to make sure that people were aware of what those performance measures are and how we're supposed to use them. And so wanted to delve into that. And then also wanted to share with you the presentations from the Finance and Administration Committee last week. They had a particularly good presentation about just how we allocate subsidies between the different modes and the different jurisdictions. And I thought you might find that of interest as a particularly hot topic right now. So in your package behind the agenda, you've got a copy of a memo that was prepared to summarize. Just a little bit of background. Back at the end of the 90s, we had something called a regional mobility panel. And it was a blue ribbon panel of VIPs and opinion makers from around the region who looked at Metro and particularly Metro Bus to identify what the course of its future should be. Role in the regional network, all the jurisdictions were starting up their own bus systems. What was Metrobus supposed to be? And after several months, and I think it was a year of deliberations, research, peer group assessments, a lot of dialogue, a little training here and there, the commitment was that Metrobus had really two purposes. One was to provide regional transportation crossing borders of the individual jurisdictions, primarily focused on high ridership services along major arterial roads, and providing access to activity centers. And at the time, I think the Council of Governments was recognizing about 24 different activity centers around the region, like Bethesda, Silver Spring, Downtown D.C., Crystal City, Pentagon, Ballston, that sort of thing, Tyson's Corner. And so they came up with a definition that determined, identified a regional route, and then whatever wasn't regional was, by definition, non-regional. That's a significance because the non-regional was the second role that Metrobus had, and that was as a provider of public transport services, if a jurisdiction wants to have a particular service operated and take advantage of the buses we have and the garages we have and the skills and drivers and assets we have, they're welcome to. But they are, they have, for the non-regional services, the discretion of the jurisdiction as to whether they want to run it with Metrobus or with someone else. And an example is 2 years ago, the district took over the N22 route with their circulator Union Station ADR. Well, that was foreseen. The N22 was established that way. When I was with Arlington, I had plotted and had planned to take over the 24B and the top part of the 10B and the top part of the 22A and provide Arlington County service with that, because they were really low ridership. They were of neighborhood significance, and it was really more an issue of the local than it was for the region. And so we have this structure, regional and non-regional, and I think this last year the non-regional subsidy was about $70 million out of our total $530 million Metrobus budget. So that gives you sort of a range of the proportion. Long way to get around to the point of this cover page, and that is that we had developed, as a result of the regional mobility panel, a series of performance measures that we wanted the regional network to achieve. Since everybody was committing as a formula participant to paying for these services, there was the fiduciary obligation that we would make sure all those services performed at a certain level. The criteria that we came up with was, number one, weekday passenger boardings. That's an indicator of sort of the is it worth doing threshold, in that there's a certain cost and effort required to maintain a bus route. Schedules, management over information, promotion, and all of those sorts of things. And so, if you're not going to have very many people on a route, then maybe it's just not worth running. And that's sort of the measure here that's intended to show. Second criteria was cost recovery. And that is sort of the measure of efficiency. And in this case, it's the amount of revenue generated by a route divided by the cost of that route. And if you are at half of the average of the region, then and above, then you're fine. If you fall below, then that's a threshold that says this route's maybe not performing as well as it should. We should take a look at it. The average subsidy per passenger was a third measure that was identified, and that was intended to show sort of the cost to the jurisdiction or the investment the jurisdiction has to provide in order to make sure that service is provided. There's sort of an equity aspect to it, in that once you get to be too expensive, is it worth as a region having those trips supported? And the other is that it sort of reflected the policy perspective of the fare setting, because the fare is really policy-based. It's not something that can be controlled by the agency. And so the subsidy was a sort of a relative measure. And then passengers per revenue trip is intended to measure the effectiveness of the use of buses and the density of the service to really get a handle for how effective the network is, how effective the service design is. And then lastly, passengers per revenue mile is sort of a measure of productivity. The higher, the better. It certainly, you want to the denser the ridership, the better, because it costs a lot more to operate. So those were the thresholds, and so moving on, you'll find a copy of our performance assessment report, and I know that Darren will probably read it in depth and then email me with some questions later, but it sort of a background material. There won't be a quiz on it. It just sort of explains some of the rule, the rationale behind it. We don't use the exact measures that were identified in this report because as we evolved, we discovered some of the information was not reliable or regularly available to us. For example, one of the things we were looking at were passenger loads on different service types, and as a budget measure, we reduced the number of traffic checkers we had, so we couldn't go out and as reliably and regularly measure what those loads were, so we found some substitute measures that gave us an indication of the crowding but didn't require those specific actions. So anyway, that was a background piece. And then you'll have a copy of the rules and regulations for Metrobus operations. Originally adopted in 1996, and all of this was revised in 2000. This is the often referenced, but seldom shown, guide as to what requires a public hearing and what doesn't. And the distinction here is if it's a major service change, then it does. And any change in fare requires a public hearing. That goes without certain saying. When you get into service changes, there's four criteria that show up on page 15 of 25. And in revenue miles, if there's an impact of more than 20% of a line's revenue miles, what that means is when the bus is in service and it's going down the street, we measure the number of miles that all the buses on a line accumulate. And effectively, if it's about 20% of the service, that would be a threshold. There's another distinction here, route miles. For example, the 32 route, I think it's 14.7 miles in length. If we were to reduce that by 15% or approximately a mile, that would be cause for a public hearing requirement. Span of service, that's from beginning to end of the day. If we change that by more than an hour. So, for example, a discussion of late night Saturday, Friday and Saturday night bus services around the region, because they run till 3:30 on the weekend, but normally they would terminate at 12:30 or 1 o'clock. That would require a public hearing because of the threshold change in span of service. And then lastly is boardings. If you're going to impact 10% of the riders on the line with whatever proposal you make, whether it be a good proposal or bad, then that would also require a public hearing. So with that definition intended to identify the major changes, then everything that's not a major becomes a minor service decrease, and that can be done under the discretion of the general manager, which is intended to allow us the flexibility to manage the system for, you know, we need an extra minute on this trip here or don't need a minute there. We need to add this trip in the middle here because we've got some crowding and we wanted to have a little bit more frequent service or not as many riders because something has changed and we can widen the headway just a little bit. It's intended to keep us from having just a bunch of unnecessary bureaucracy and comments. It doesn't take us away from the obligation to be transparent and open and make sure we are gathering input from the public, but just from a policy and Metro Compact standpoint. Those were the definitions. And so then the public hearing process is also identified, and it's just important sometimes to recognize that I don't sit upstairs and just randomly make this stuff up. You do actually have some more guidelines. And then lastly, in here is the actual document that speaks to the guidelines and how they get used. And this is an important point to emphasize. In all things, these are guidelines, not standards. These are performance measures, not cut lists. These are not staff recommendations. Everything is subject to the decisions made by the board. And so we have to constantly remind folks that there isn't a threshold, that if you fall below this threshold, you're automatically out of here. There's nothing automatic. Everything is contextual, and ultimately the responsibility of the board to make a decision about one service or another. And what these guidelines do is when you identify a line that's not performing particularly well, then we're expected to go and try and figure out what can be done to make it improved. And page 24 or 25, there's a discussion about guidelines for reducing service on existing lines. And before you get to reducing service, your obligation is to try and hear the phrase is integrate headways along the corridor. Excuse me, what that means is if you've got 6-minute headways, try 7-minute headways. Rather than eliminating the route, try adjusting the trips. If you've got a trip that's arriving at 9:05, try moving it back to 8:55. Maybe getting a little bit earlier allows people to arrive on time to work, and there's a market reason. Replace a larger bus with a smaller bus. Sometimes a good idea, sometimes not. The cost of operating a bus, a big bus versus a small bus, is so marginal that it doesn't really change it. But, for example, on some of the routes up in Northwest, we did buy a fleet. DC funded the purchase of a fleet of small buses that were used specifically on those routes as a way to have right size equipment. One option is to short turn it. An example is on the 14th Street line, instead of having all the buses go all the way up to Tacoma Park, have some turn back at Cleveland. We have a transit center there. Saves you a lot of time, puts buses along the part of the route where they're needed. And then lastly is public information. If people don't know what's there, will they be able to use it? Falls in the woods to anybody here. It's the same sort of a challenge. And so the obligation is to take all of these actions before we actually get to the point of trying to recommend an actual reduction. That was the vision of the mobility panel and the actual board adopted policies, and that's what officially stands as Metro practice. So I'm happy to answer any questions.
We'll follow our procedure of going around. So, Patrick, any questions? Ron? Stephen? Ron? Joseph? Victoria?
Could you give me an example of the radio across town in the crosstown bus?
Gauge 2 and 4 would be a crosstown.
Okay.
The 70 line would be a radio. We used to have a hub and spoke network where everybody came downtown and all the bus routes just radiated out from that. That's the definition. So you can see on a map very clearly the routes that go out, and then the ones that don't are either the H line, the E line. Those are good examples of ones that go across town.
Thank you.
different?
Yes. I have the closest one.
Hammer.
Hammer. Hammer. About the performance measure. Do you use the best possible to play a box that is computerized and figure out how many people are boarding the bus, how many people pay for, how many people get off? Is that part of the performance measure?
The answer is absolutely. That is, the fare box is a critical component of where we get our information on the number of riders, on the revenue generated by a particular route. Particularly with the transition to Smart Trip, we have more and more data and can get more and more precise in terms of exactly where people are getting on and getting off. We've also added a few years ago something called automatic passenger counters. And so we're now getting enough on the fleet. I think we're up to 800 of the 1,200 buses have the data collection, so we can start generating reports that tell us on a more frequent and real-time basis exactly how many people are riding and what bus stops they're getting on at and getting off at. And so we're being able to expand the amount of information, which hopefully will make us be able to be more precise in our recommendations for service.
Thank you. And Councilor?
Thank you, Mr. Hammond, for this information. It's really useful. So great thing to know that it's out there. I have a few questions, and I'll just say whichever one you have the time to answer for, please answer. But I just want, I guess, the questions to go on record, just to trigger my memory as I look at the minutes later on. My first question is, the route performance assessment report, is that made publicly available when it's done, or is it available to board members that request the results of that assessment report? And then on what frequency is that line performance assessment or route performance assessment report done? And then lastly, can the community input, is there a community input factor to requesting an evaluation? Or a community says this line no longer meets our needs, we're willing to trade this bus route for another bus route. Do we have to go to our council members, our elected officials, or can we come directly to a MOP and place a request for an evaluation?
The route performance assessment is done on a biannual basis. The report is provided to the jurisdictions, jurisdictional staff, board members when they're interested or when they're deliberating on a public hearing. This is oftentimes referenced in that. As far as community input, that's really the purpose behind the service rules and the board process. And certainly, every action requires a constituency. So the answer is yes. You need to engage council members, your board members, your representatives in order to build the support for any particular recommendation. And we're always happy to meet and talk, and that's why we created our planning processes for the different studies, so we have an organized way to be able to input and have that input influence our recommendations. But when we do a public hearing, the intent is not to put out, well, here's what we decided to do and we're just telling you. The intent is, here's a range of alternatives, and we'd like your input as to impact, alternative ideas, priority, and then we take that input and we'll sometimes recraft the proposal. And a perfect example was Greenbelt. This last year, we put out a plan early October, I think, revised it a little bit. It went out as part of the public hearing docket. We got a lot of very specific and directed input, and we actually changed around about half of what was in the plan to respond to that. And so that's part of the process of reaching a conclusion. And then the board in the public session will approve that final plan, and that's also an opportunity for folks to give a final comment on the final action.
Thank you.
I have a couple of questions. First of all, just with the Metro Bus Service Guidelines and Bus Service Criteria, which is on page one of our packet, we've got daily weekly passing warnings, passenger radio, which is a passenger, et cetera. I was just wondering if you had examples of these criteria applied to routes, so we just kind of see like how it may be played out against, you know, a set of routes or a route family like the S route or the S buses or something like that. That's one question. And then I guess I'd also just kind of be curious how kind of the criteria in this presentation kind of play into service adjustments that are budget-driven. How, you know, okay, here are all of our criteria for whether, you know, a route is sort of a level that's will not funded as opposed to DASH or ART-driven, you know, okay, but now we don't have quite enough subsidy to actually pay for it, and so we get these service adjustments, service reductions, where we're cutting service on route, how that plays into the criteria that we are established for
out of
service. So those are my two questions. One, and for example, another more kind of policy question.
Okay. Well, number one, I don't have an example with me tonight, but I would be happy to provide that through John to the committee at a later time. The information does have a role in the budget process, and then, for example, last year the board asked us to come up with a list of recommendations to take to public hearing. So we went to our productivity report, and obviously the routes that showed up at the bottom of the list were put on the table for consideration to whether we should continue to run them or not. It's an easy way to not the criteria require it, but when you array everything, the information it provides you says it's much more likely that the 18E is a less productive, less regionally significant service than, for example, the S4. And so it's a way to identify that. It is not the only criteria that we use. It is simply an information piece. We also look at a whole host of different things, ranging from access and mobility requirements, public policy. For example, Montgomery County has a standard for frequency of bus service that's different than Prince George's, so we'll look at those to see if we're compliant. Crowding. Passenger loads. So that's a driver for about 57 lines in the system in terms of the actual frequency of service that we operate. We look at the network. You know, maintaining access around the region is part of our goal and obligation. If you take out a major connector like the D8 route, for example, going to Washington Hospital Center, that would have a regionally significant impact, because that's obviously a major employment site, healthcare site, and the connection would be important. So we wouldn't do that. But, you know, those are the process that we go through as professionals. And other criteria like that. I think there's 25 different actions that I take that's on that list that the planners and I use.
Chris. Just a couple of things. The route performance assessment, so that's done biannually?
Yes.
And does that include every route?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, the specific guidelines of the board action applies to the regional network, but we also apply the same evaluation to the non-regional as a way to keep the jurisdictions informed on how the services are performed.
Okay. And the other question I had was, for all the routes that Metrobus operates, would you be able to say now, or how many of them at this point don't meet these guidelines for service?
Well, I believe the answer is there's 36 routes that fail on one or more of the measures.
And that's out of a total of?
Out of a total of 166.
Anything else?
Okay. I wanted to ask you a question about a specific bus. Since I have not made any of the board meetings, unfortunately, have they done anything with the B30? Because, you know, that's my bus.
Yes.
One of your buses.
Yes.
One of my main buses.
Well, no, actually, we have initiated a study of the B30, and hopefully you've logged on and given us your opinion. And that's the only thing that's going on right now. The B30 and the 5A, we implemented the $6 fare on last year, and let's see, I'm trying to remember, I believe the B30 ridership is down about 20%, but the revenue is up 50%. And so it's on in the performance measures, it's at or very close to being a fully funded operation. So it would be very hard to justify any reductions. In fact, it might be appropriate to recommend improvements for those. And that's why we started the study, so we could document just what would be a benefit.
Okay, and my second question is, are you still doing the checking? You know how maybe one of your employees is on the bus and they check how many people get on this stop. Do you do that for a month or do you just do it for 1 week? Because say for example, Monday is a holiday. Well, you're not going to have that many people. Maybe Tuesday you may not have that many people, but Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, you may have what you would possibly have Monday or Tuesday if it wasn't a holiday.
Well, we have four different ways that we monitor ridership. One is the fare box, and we look at those reports on a regular basis, and we look at them on a daily basis, and we can parse them down to the hour and the trip, and so we can look at that. We do still have 18 traffic checkers on staff, and they do go out, and when we need a particular route observed, they'll actually sit on the bus, and they have a form that they fill out, and they identify what bus stops people get on and what they get off at, and the number of people. It's called a ride check, and it tells us boardings and alightings, it tells us run time between stops and between time points, and it tells us peak passenger loads. That's a more extensive effort, and obviously because we're now down 30 positions from where we were 5 years ago, we don't do that as often. But we have moved to substituting a lot of point checks. I got this complaint that we're getting a lot of crowding on the 54 bus at Irving Street, southbound. And so we'll send a traffic checker out there and they'll stand at the corner and they're really good at estimating how many people are on each bus as it goes by. And so they'll give us a list and then we can apply our measures and analyze what the passenger flow is, the crowding, to see if more buses are needed or if we need to change something. And then the fourth way is we're the newly evolving automatic passenger counters. And what that does is it's counting all day, every trip. And so you'll end up with 2,000 trips that you can then develop highs and lows and standard deviations. And you can do all of your statistical assessments to figure out just what is the what is happening there. And that helps us overcome the single observation challenge to make sure we're getting, okay, we go out on Tuesday, there's a traffic accident, ridership's different. Come back on Wednesday, that's the last day of the month, that coincides with the Friday, and Social Security checks get sent out, and by golly, you're going to have a lot of riders on that day. So traditionally, our planners have used something they call a high daily average. So they'll take the ridership on all the Mondays of the month, all the Tuesdays, all the Wednesdays, and they'll take the highest day of each of those and then average them across the week to come up with a high daily average total for the month. It's usually about 10% overstated of what the real number is, but it's intended to give an indication of how much capacity needs to be out there. And so that's another tool that we use to make sure that we're getting enough buses out there and making sure that they're in the right places.
Okay, one more thing. The 70 and 71 should be checked, if possible.
And the 79.
Yes.
What we're seeing is that well, punching aside from that, what we've seen is the continued shift of folks from the 70s onto the limited stop 79. 79 is carrying 6,700 riders a day. The 70 line, which used to carry 18,000, is down to about 11,000 because all the adults moved on to the blue bus, so the kids could ride up and down on the white buses. And so we're constantly looking to see if the headway on the 70s needs to be adjusted. As an example of what we do.
Okay, thank you very much.
Jim, I'd like to have you think about Purple Line, but actually first in context, I guess the Silver Line.
For us, the Purple Line is Rex down in Richmond Highway, because their buses are purple.
Rex. I mean, one will bring people into the system or into the portals that are now taxed, but there may be bus opportunities to bring people to that service. By contrast, the Purple Line is to serve people that now might ride buses between those points. And if they do ride rail, they have to come pass through the center city. What's the timing of studies that will be done?
Well, let's see. A couple of things. One, we have done a major study on the J line, which is basically across Montgomery County, paralleling much of the Purple Line route. Next year, we'll be doing the F4, F6, which is the other half of the Purple Line, going from Silver Spring over to New Carrollton. So we will have, as part of a corridor study, the concept of what we want to do with the bus service so long as it's a bus corridor, and we also get some general ideas of what we would do when it turns into a street or light rail corridor. For the most part, it doesn't change a lot, because the light rail is stopping I think so more frequently than twice a mile, and sometimes there's more than that between stops. And there'll still be a need in between to help distribute. When you're parallel, plus there'll be a lot more, folks traveling down New Hampshire Avenue to transfer at University Boulevard, for example. And so, as we were doing the K6 study, we were looking a little bit at what was happening at the Four Corner major intersection to see if that would give us an indication of what future alternatives would be. As we get closer and the actual schedules and operating dates get aligned, get determined, then we'll sit down and actually do what we call rail study to see. It's similar to what we did with Metro Rail, where we did a rail turnback study. When the Orange Line was extended to Ballston, for example, we restructured the bus services that used to go to Roslyn so they could interface with rail at Ballston, and then when it was extended, we similarly did another one. We would do something like that, and we'd go back through and look at each of the routes interacting with the Purple Line and working with the jurisdictions and the MTA come up with a plan that would balance it out. So a lot of times you'll see the jurisdiction wants to reduce the bus service so they can use that money to pay for the new light rail service.
One other thing, if I might, how many articulated buses are there, and is there an easy way to summarize where they're used?
Well, right now we have 70 in the fleet. They're used on the X line, the X2, They're used on the 70 line for the 70-71. The Y line up in Montgomery County. And occasionally we'll borrow one to put on the 16th Street S line. But that's generally limited. In our fleet management plan, we had recommended doubling the number of RTECs. There's 16th Street, 14th Street, the Q line. There are other places that we think could benefit, the 90s line, could benefit from having larger capacity vehicles. Sometimes you can put out more buses, but sometimes buses get in their way, in each other's way. And they get lonely and they want to bunch up and have their friends with them as they go down the street. And one way to deal with that is to have a larger capacity vehicle separated more. So, you know, once you get below 5 minutes apart, it's hard to keep that 5 minutes apart. So it's easier to have a larger bus. And so there are opportunities for us, but the limitation is that we don't have any place to park them or maintain them. We run out of space that can support them. And so we're very excited that the new Shepherd Park bus facility down in the south point of D.C. will have a capability for articulated coaches. And so as we make plans for future bus purchases and services, there'll be an opportunity within the district at least to expand the number of RTECs. And and then we're hopefully at some point we'll get some money to be able to expand Montgomery division to add some additional bus bays so that you can maintain more buses out of that division.
Thank you.
Thanks for your presentation. I'm wondering, with this current budget process, I think probably staff and the general manager will be asked to, you know, prepare recommendations again regarding bus service. And I'm assuming, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the board already has access to those 36 routes that might not meet all the criteria or don't meet all the criteria. Is this something that's been presented to the board yet?
The presentations to the board this year, you have to identify what day you made that presentation, because the board has changed so much that the information isn't uniform. For example, one of the Maryland representatives was appointed on Wednesday and came to the meeting last week on Thursday. He hadn't seen any of the materials that had been presented December or January. The other three members of Maryland haven't even been seated yet. And so I guess the answer is at various times, yes, we've shared information with the board members and their staff. So the list is basically the same as it has been for a number of years. And so there is information there. They have not. This is a really unique process we're going through this year because of the transfer. I think Mr. Downs pointed out that except for when the board was first created, there has never been a case of so many new board members at one time. And so we're having to sort of redo the entire information process as they go forward. And so at this point, we haven't been asked for a recommendation.
I thought from listening to the Finance Committee, my understanding was that the board was starting to ask for direction on possible service adjustments in case they could not increase the subsidy to the full amount that's required.
Well, we kept sort of waiting and we're prepared to offer opinions and recommendations when asked, but haven't been asked yet. Last week, the board was met to make some determinations, and they ended up deciding to wait until this week. So we're going to have a conversation tomorrow, and perhaps out of that some direction. So far, we haven't been. The general manager's recommendation was $72 million in additional subsidy, and his recommendation was maintain the service that we have. That's what we heard last year from the public, extensive public hearing package. 242 pages of bus descriptions. And so he reflected that in his budget recommendation, and so far hasn't changed that.
So if I'm understanding what you're saying correctly, that maybe we should look back at last year's docket regarding bus service to kind of maybe get a hint of those routes that might not be meeting all the criteria, or is there any way that we would have access to that information?
Absolutely. Last year's budget, the public hearing docket, represented a lot of work and our best thoughts and ideas on what we would actually do if we were challenged to reduce services. And unfortunately, we aren't any smarter this year, and we have the same bus routes. So a lot of the same recommendations are applicable. So that would be a really good indicator of what's possible. Because, you know, in most cases, you wouldn't just go wipe out an entire route. You would take the first trip and the last trip and maybe reduce some of the midday service to preserve where you were most productive and serving the highest number of people. That's our approach, is the nip and tuck. On the other hand, you could just say, you know, enough is enough, and like no one has done that for a long time.
Thank you.
Well, again, I'd like to add my thanks, Mr. Henry, to you being here. One thing that may be apparent or may not be apparent is that we don't have a comparable person in rail to talk about similar guidelines. And I'm going to ask you an unfair question, because you may not be able to answer it. It may not be in your purview. But is the absence of such guidelines from rail, from the rail side, is that just an accident of the history of how this originated, or the nature of the malleability of the bus system versus the rail system? Or, and if you have any insight into how rail makes their decisions, that would be helpful.
I think you hit upon it. The bus network by nature is a lot more malleable and requires continuous attention. I respect and appreciate the rail folks, but they've only got five routes. I don't know why they take so much. Why are they moaning to make a decision about where to take the blue route? I did nine of those last December. Part of it goes also back to the history of the organization. It was created to build a railroad. The board has always had a very proprietary interest in the decisions about rail service. And so they never created guidelines because they didn't want to give any discretion to staff to change rail service. So every action to change a rail headway or frequency pathways is really subject to board review and action. Last year, in the transition between Mr. Cato and Mr. Sorrells, Mr. Cato had staff put together a recommendation for a rail equivalent service guidelines. And then he left and went to California. And when Mr. Sorrells came in, the board made it pretty clear that they weren't prepared to talk about that sort of thing. And so it got tabled. And so that was the most recent effort to try and give some guidance to rail. And it may come back up again because the amount of ad hoc service schedule change necessary to do all of the capital construction. And Mr. Downs, a couple meetings ago, was raising the issue not whether or not we should run late night weekend service to support the entertainment industry, but really, how are we going to spend $1 billion a year on the railroad? How do you do that with the least impact on the people riding it? And that may require us to come back and start talking about, well, what discretion do you want to give staff to be able to go, say, you know, next week on the red line north of Silver Spring, we're going to run half-hour headways because we're doing, you know, major track work action. Or do you want that to have every action like that to have to come to the board for approval before you can do that? what is the new norm for business practices for rail? And so I think you'll get an opportunity to talk more about that. Thank you. But in answer to your question, how rail makes their decisions, you know, most of the time we're given a dollar target. You know, I need $3 million worth of savings. And then we as staff go and find out, well, you know, what can we do that will have the least impact on the on ridership and return that kind of a cost, whether it be, and these are the same things that come up year after year, you know, closing mezzanines after 8 p.m. at night or on the weekend. Every mezzanine has to have a staff person. So if you close a mezzanine, that saves you that staff person starting later, closing earlier, you know, running the railroad reduces the costs. Whether you open a station or not, you know, those are the types of things. And then there's, you know, the actual production. How many rail cars do you put out? What's the headway that you're running? It's a very formula-driven budget based on rail car miles and service, the number of hours that you're operating. And so when you change that one thing, it's very easy to predict what the impact is in the savings.
Great, thank you. Joseph, you have a question?
Yeah, just real quick. I was going to ask you, but Ms. Daniels, maybe you think of something. On the B30 route, which you say ridership is down, but revenue is up. You guys are working on a study on that route. Is that what you said? Does a part of that study include where those riders went? I know that I used to use the B30 a lot when I traveled, but there's no reason for me to use it anymore because it's more than the MART train now. And so MART train is really faster and it costs less. And I know that when I did use the B30, I traveled more frequently to the airport. A lot of those people were people who worked at the airport. And so if I pay $6, $12 a day on transportation, and that's just on this one bus, including the bus that I took to get there, I probably wouldn't be able to afford that very long working at the airport. I'm just questioning, will that be a part of where any of these people didn't just disappear?
We are doing a survey of the ridership, not so much to get origin to destination, but to find out how folks are using it, why they're using it, and the relationship particularly between transfers to and from Metro Rail and Greenbelt and what folks are doing at BWI. Because there's a trip pattern developing that I wasn't aware of until the last time I talked with Ms. Daniels. Folks will ride out to BWI and then get on the light rail to go into Baltimore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I had thought about that. But since you mentioned it, a number of other people have mentioned they do that. And so we're trying to get a feel for just what is that transfer. Does that suggest we should do something in partnership with the MTA?
Okay. And then the last question that I have, and this is kind of narrow on what you've been here, but just on the bus in general, if there's a disruption, something wrong with the trains, I see it right on the Metro website. I don't have to look for it. Since I log into the Metro website, it's right there. It tells me what it is. Most of the time, I get it on my Twitter feed or whatever. Is there a way to do something like that similar for buses? And mainly because, for instance, I know there's a way to get the information. It's just not always so prevalent and easy to access as for trains. In Chevrolet, for instance, right now, they're carrying all southbound lanes on Chevrolet Avenue are closed. And for the first 3 days of the week, people didn't know where to catch the bus. And so they just didn't know. The town didn't know where the bus was going. The town didn't know that the bus had started to go up Bellevue, which is like one lane, and all the way around. And so people didn't know where to catch the bus for 3 days. And so is there a way to, I guess, push that information to the forefront?
Right. Well, actually, that's a project that we have initiated and met on just yesterday. What exists today on the website all the planned detours that we know about are listed on the bus tab under detours. And so I'm surprised about the Charlotte experience because I thought that information was on there. We have been partnering because we discovered that there's three different groups generating bus service information. There's the planned detour, something we know because the road's going to be closed to a construction project. Special events, I hate to say it, but a marathon, for example, is going to impact bus services. We tried to put events about upcoming detours on the page, and then sort of the real-time unplanned events, detours because of there's a fire in an apartment building on 16th Street and the fire department closed the road, that sort of thing. We were doing pretty good about the planned events. Our special events, the information was getting there, but it wasn't getting there in as user-friendly a form. And so we've instituted some changes and assigned some staff to spend some time writing more. And what we've discovered is that our real-time information, service disruption, isn't getting there as regularly as it needs to be. And so we're just trying to define what that standard is. In fact, I'll ask you all for your input. Right now, the threshold is if it's an impact that's going to last for more than 3 hours, they'll put a notice on the webpage under bus status tab. We think that that threshold should be something lower than that, like perhaps if it's going to last for 15 minutes or 30 minutes, then it's worth the time to put it on, and people may benefit from that sort of thing. I'd be interested in what sort of a frequency. And then the last component of that is we have 166 routes. When the IT folks thought about adding an e-alert system, or a bus, 166 variations blew their mind and they stopped. I said, well, wait a minute, I don't have to be able to customize a message to every individual on their individual bus trip. What I need is Northwest DC, there's a problem on the 31, 32, for example, is blocked. Well, then I have a choice because I know I can take 31 or I can shift over and catch a D2, or I could do something else. And so what we're going to initially roll out is chopping the region up into meaningful sectors, so we only have maybe 10 or 14 choices. And that's something that IT thought they could more readily handle. But then to fully utilize that, we need staff who are ready to communicate and do something. Once I know something, what do I do with it? In May, our bus operations control center is going to move from a closet in the basement of this building out to a new facility at Carmen Turner. We're going to have 11 stations for staff. We're going to have some new staff. We're going to have a dedicated person to do communications about bus changes, bus issues. And so then we'll be able to support, if we do it right, we'll have the technology and we'll have someone to use the technology to communicate that information outward. That's this spring's optimistic hope that we're going to be able to provide more real-time and planned information about changes we make to us.
I would just hope that eventually we would get to the point where it's right there on the homepage, even if at the bottom it says service instruction on these routes or on these lines. So just like it is for the train, I used to train more. I didn't know about this until I'm on the Shelby listserv, and I mean, I'm forward to very happy with you.
If you look at the web page on the left side, there's a service status.
Right.
And the first tab, of course, is rail.
Right.
But if you click on the one behind that, you get the bus tab, and that's where we should have our immediate event sort of information about what's happening on the system. And then we're going to try and provide cross-links, because right now you can find out about bus detours, I think it's in 6 different drop-down menus across the top. Well, who's going to know to look under 6 different places to find different nuances? So So we're going to try and consolidate it all under the bus tab with links to all these other places so we'll get a full list of the information that's there.
Thanks. Ms. Daniels, I wanted you to have the privilege of the last question.
Oh, okay. This is in reference to the B-30. Ridership will be up once spring comes in. And another thing I wanted to know is may I use my smart trip in Baltimore? Because people from Washington know about the B-30, but the people from Baltimore, and of course, I know a lot of people in Baltimore, and I have told them about a lot of people don't know, plus the bus drivers don't know. Some of the bus drivers, I told them, you know, and they're going to Lexington Market and all like that. So there is a charm trip fare car. So can we use it interchanged in both states?
The original intent was that it would be seamless transportation across the state of Maryland. So the answer is you're supposed to be able to use our smart card or their charm card on either system. Now, I will hold a caveat in case it doesn't work the next time you try it. Please let me know because then we'll look at it.
It works. MTA person says it does.
Good. I believe Mr. Webster. He does
not. Well, Mr. Hamrick, thank you. You stayed longer than we asked you to, and you were very exhaustive and comprehensive in your comments, and we appreciate the education that you've given us and that you always give.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you much.
Can I just sneak in after Jim, just to let you know, there's some additional information from last week's Finance Committee meeting. And what you all may be interested in is the timeline from this first presentation. It's on, I don't know where it is, page 10 of 39 on the second presentation. But just to let you know, the board is meeting tomorrow to further discuss the budget. And we'll hopefully be approving, as it stands right now, plan to approve public hearings on the 14th. And so Metro is looking at assuming they do have public hearings, looking at those in the May time frame. So more information to come, I guess, is just what I wanted to tell folks.
And let me also acknowledge that my boss, Jack Rakewood, the Assistant General Manager for Bus, is here.
Good evening. And, I trust Jim, but I wanted to listen.
Trust but verify.
All right, thank you all.
All right, thank you.
All right.
Okay, moving right along, we already done the RAC MDAC chair report, so next item is to give you a report back from the discussion of interests that we had at last meeting. Let me introduce that topic by saying what many of the new members might not know, but I think the members who were here last year would know, is that every month in the week following our monthly meeting, the vice chairs and myself and the vice chairs and the chair and John Pasek meet for an evening meeting to plan the next RAC meeting's agenda and to just keep up on business, general business of the RAC. And so that's where we, at this past month's meeting, we took all the information we got from you on your interests and analyzed them and tried to see how we could fit all of them in. And we realized that we probably would keep the same committee structure that we had as of last year, which is a bus committee, a budget committee, a governance committee, a long-term projects committee, and an elevator and escalator committee, and public and to approve the public safety task force that we established last meeting. And we thought that those committees would be would comprise all of the interests that were expressed, or at least most of the interests that were expressed. We did want to make one extra thing that we noticed in looking at all of the topics, that fares, meaning fair media and fair payment systems, and communications and public safety, those three items seem to be highest on the priority list. So we will definitely take those into account in all of the future planning for this year, for presentations, for meetings, for issues to investigate. Also, and part of the reason I explained about the monthly meeting that the vice chairs and the chair and Tron have, is to say that if you do have agenda item topics that you are interested in, please let us know, and we'll definitely consider them and see how we can best integrate them into the RECS plan. So are there any questions about that or comments about that structure? Okay, then we'll again just appeal that we would like your input, your continued input, that discussion last month wasn't the end of the discussion. So please be in communication with us about your interests and issues.
I realized that you should have all gotten a list that was emailed to you, and I realized that I didn't print out a hard copy of your packet. So if you don't have it and you need it, I can either print it for you after the meeting or email it to you again. So I'm sorry, that was an oversight on my part.
Okay, we now go into committee meeting reports. The first committee, our chair is not here, Carl Seid. I think we have a letter to approve. I don't know if he wanted to introduce that. Should we wait for him?
John? Carl contacted me over the day and asked that I present. If he couldn't make it,
great.
I hope to be here at 9, but he obviously isn't, so I'll go ahead and present the letter. First of all, thank you, John, for issuing the calendar. One of the important things for me to know is that if there are any associations that need to be done to balance the budget under the calendar, they already don't take effect until September. So if the board should delay the public hearing process even further, then you're already left with trying to get a year's worth of savings after 9 months worth of service changes. You'd be looking at, trying to get a year's worth of savings at 8 months of service changes. So with that in mind, the budget committee met in March. What date do we meet on?
The Monday following, maybe the 14th?
Okay.
Early teens.
To discuss the fiscal year 2012 budget. As you all know, the general manager has proposed a budget that assumes a $72 million increase in the subsidies provided by the Omaha Compact members and no services. However, it's not entirely certain that the Compact members will come up with a $72 million increase, or all of them will. So we began to discuss what the issues were, and there basically, if you look at the three bullets on the letter, which is the last best package, and then we'll move on. First is that we believe that any reductions in service should be greater than what the possibility of savings are needed so that providers can weigh in. So in other words, if you need $30 million worth of savings, don't publish for public hearing $30 million worth of, you know, savings, publish 45 so that the public can weigh in. The second was that under board policy fares, the general manager can only increase the fare as part of his budget proposal biannually, so there was no fare increase in the general manager's budget, and that was per Metro Board policy. We felt that a service cuts were on the table, that the public should also weigh in on possible fare increases that could make any possible service cuts unnecessary. And finally, any other budget actions. If you look in the presentation that's in your package, this one, the management did propose some one-time options on page 8 of 39, and all of them have some repercussions for future year revenue. And in the case of station naming rights, right now the advertising market is down, and if you sell naming rights for 30 years, you may not get the maximum revenue if that structure can. Preventative maintenance means that there's less capital, et cetera, et cetera. That the repercussions for each of those one-time options to help balance the budget should be made public. So with that in mind, and with the fact that the budget committee for our job is meeting tomorrow via teleconference?
Technically it's the board, because only the board is allowed to meet via teleconference.
Okay.
So the board is meeting tomorrow via teleconference to discuss budget.
The board is meeting tomorrow to discuss providing guidance to management in providing or putting together a proposal for what to go to public hearing on. The committee would ask that the RAC approve the letter that's on the last page of your packet, item 8.
So you're moving what?
Yes, I move that the RAC approve item 8A, is it 8A of the agenda, the letter.
And is there a second?
Any of the line seconded?
Thank you.
Any discussion of the letter?
My question is, on here, your option for possible hearing, is that just to help frame the public's mind on if we want to save the services, how much it will cost?
Yes, and actually under federal regulations, if there are any fare increases that are considered or service cuts, Metro has to advertise those by public hearing. It's also in their own procedures. And so if a fare increase is not advertised, it's not an option, and same thing with a service, significant service cut. If it's not advertised as part of the public hearing, then it's not an option that the board has in order to help balance the budget if that's what
right.
is
necessary. I guess what we're asking them is to add something to the budget discussion, which is not part of the budget.
That's correct, so that buyers can weigh in on it and it not be an option. Because if it's not advertised, then the only option is to cut service if the jurisdiction don't fund the additional subsidy.
Deborah?
Do you
have
my looking at 8:39 under the option, and what can we say to name you, right? Is it the same as the advertisement?
No, I think the idea is, it's Ronald Reagan National Airport, so an entity could buy the naming rights of the station, and then the station would become, Acme Bethesda Station, and it would be on all the station signs and all the announcements. In exchange, they would pay some amount of money to Metro for the rights to have it named for some amount of years. But right now, the advertising market isn't good. So if the choice of Metro is to name stations, then this is probably not the best time to do it because the revenue that Metro would get is not optimal.
Amy?
I'm very supportive of this letter. I just have a hopefully small, friendly amendment. The last sentence of the first paragraph where it ends, come up with additional operating funds. I would recommend changing that to close the operating budget deficit with increased subsidies alone, because it's possible that they could come up with some increased subsidies and not close the gap, but we don't want to say we don't want those subsidies to be increased. I was wondering if we could change the wording so it kind of, it still encourages them to increase the subsidy.
Yeah, sure. Why don't you make a plain amendment and read exactly what the wording should be for that last sentence?
Okay. I'll start with, we can move the sentence. As you continue your deliberations on Metro's fiscal year 2012 budget and prepare to decide on the scope and framework of the public's involvement in the budget process, Riders Advisory Council asks that you present a clear menu of options to the public for comment if the jurisdictions are unable to close the operating budget deficit with increased subsidies alone.
Yeah, that's a friendly mind to that.
Sorry?
What? There are three bullets here. How is this different from what they've presented in the past? What are you asking to do that's additional?
The fare increases right now, like last year, they advertised fare increases and service cuts. Right now, the general manager's budget does not have any fare increase in it. So if that were what were to go to public hearing, then there would only be service cuts and fare increases would not be advertised, which means that if there was a shortfall, it would all have to come from service cuts. So that's, we're asking the board to add fare increases as a possible option for which riders could weigh in on, not to say that there were four fare increases. The other thing is for these one-time actions, which the board has taken in previous years, so last year they shifted $30 million off the capital budget to preventative maintenance. That has an effect because that's $30 million of capital projects that were not done. So we're just asking that the board be explicit in when they present those options, that they talk about what the long-term ramifications of those actions are.
I think it makes it sound as if you haven't gotten some of these things in the past, how they prepare for public meetings. It's not clear here, like, which one of these bullets they've done in the past and which one isn't doing what you want to add. Because right now it sounds as if you've never gotten this information in the past.
If I can interrupt, they generally haven't. Like, the first bullet, if you look at the docket last year, it said what Metro was planning on cutting. But as a member of the public, you would see, okay, Metro's planning on cutting, you know, trips off of this route, but it didn't tell you, as a, you know, as someone who is expected to weigh in, how much money we'd save or how many riders would be affected. So it would be harder for you looking at that to make a good decision, you know, to give good input to the board that says, well, okay, you're going to affect 1,000 people and you're only going to save, you know, $500. Is it really worth it? Whereas you're going to affect 10 people and you're going to save $100,000. Is that it? Just more information. And I don't believe that they've included that in the docket before.
John, I think they didn't include the cost savings of each one. That's right. They didn't okay. include the passenger, and they did include the revenue loss and passenger loss, but you had to dig into the appendix to find it.
Okay.
So all of these three things would be new then? You think, John?
I don't know. Darm seems to think that they provided this information.
I think they provided
some of it.
Savings. I remember at the debate about one of the Metro closing the open weekend and was going to save like $100,000.
Yeah, and I don't think we're saying this was specifically the council asked the board to direct staff and prepare the public meetings to provide information regarding. I don't think we have said that they've never provided in the past. It's just that we're asking for this, for all of this to be included. And right now, things are very fluid because the only proposal that's right now on the table and open is the general manager's budget, which assumes a $72 million increase in operating subsidies from the member jurisdictions. And there's nothing else on the table. And under that, there'd be no service cuts and there'd be no fare increases. However, if that subsidy increase doesn't materialize, then what we're asking is, right now, everything would be made up in service cuts, and they can, John, you correct me if I'm wrong, but there have been various service cuts offered to the board, and since they don't really have committees or committees as a whole, to the budget committee at various times, but nothing has really been made available to the public, so we're just asking that all this information be included in the docket so that all of this is something that people can comment on, that's all. And again, under board policy, it's to have a biannual fare increase. There would be no fare increase this year.
Okay, Hannah?
Okay, third paragraph, that introductory sentence before the bullets. Hopefully this is a friendly amendment, but the ask in this sentence is a little muddled as written. Specifically, the council asked the board direct staff in preparing for public meetings on the budget to provide information regarding I think what you're trying to say is put the information in the docket so it's available to the public. And kind of as written, it's like, are you asking WMATA to send the information to the RIC? Are you asking, I think what we're trying to say is put it in the docket for the public, then I think we should say put it in the docket for the public. Okay, yeah. So something like, specifically the council has the board direct staff to include in the docket for public meetings on the budget information regarding. So I guess it would be eliminate in preparing for and say direct staff to include in the docket, include in the docket for public meetings on the budget, and then just also eliminate the to provide information regarding. Does that work for people? Okay.
I just also want to remind people that we do have a policy now of approving in principle, so maybe some of the wordsmithing here. And you feel it's a substantive thing, we should bring it up, but if it's just wordsmithing, we could do that after approving.
Well, I do want to say that since the board is meeting tomorrow,
I'm hoping to get this to them tonight.
So
yeah, we'll take the time. You're right.
This is your best bite at the apple.
Yes.
For this letter, I agree with the three bullet points. While I think those of us that are very familiar with the budget, we kind of know how to sift through documents whenever it was available. But I remember going to, I think, some of the hearings and listening to public comment that wasn't fully informed. But I wonder what their commentary would have been had they had better information in a more user-friendly format. So I like both the suggestion that you made, both the suggestions you made to place it where and by what day or when or whatever.
Deborah?
We got a letter today because of the board member who's the board meeting tomorrow. I wonder if there's going to be any attachment, like separate annotation, or are we going to update? Because we have 2,200 of this question. We're going to have to attach the letter, like separate annotation.
Will there be attachments?
I don't think there was an intent to have attachments because we're asking for general information and we may not have examples of what specifically we want because, as John pointed out, in some cases Metro may not have provided that information in the past.
Right. I mean, there's not an intention to have attachments. We're asking them to do something. So.
And there's not an example. I'm sorry. There's not an example of what we've done. What they've done in the past, we can say this is what we want. We can't refer to that. In some cases, they haven't provided this. In some cases, we're asking for something very general, like the consideration of fare increases as part of the docket.
Okay. It doesn't look like there's any more questions or comments. So let's move to a vote. All in favor of approving this letter, raise your hand. Anyone opposed? Anyone abstained? Okay, it passed unanimously. Thank you. And thank you to the Budget Committee and to our erstwhile chair. We'll move on to the report from long-term projects, which will be briefer than our chair of long-term projects, David Albert, is not here, but Penny will report that.
In the long-term projects committee, we had a presentation by staff on the proposed open fare system.
which essentially the idea is that eventually people would be able to use other things other than a smart trip card and cash and paper fare card to use the Metro system, perhaps use a credit card, perhaps use an ID where your value would be stored upon that as opposed to the traditional fare medium that we're accustomed to. Our understanding is that it's in the very early stages, but it was a very interesting presentation. And so it was mainly informative at this point. And Joseph and John, anybody else, do you have anything to add?
I don't hear anyone else.
No, I think the main purpose of it is, the main gist of the meeting is that to allow more people to use more different things in order to access Metro, not necessarily just the additional trip cards, in order to get away from Metro being the vendor of Metro fare and move more solely towards just being the collector of the fare. And so they want to get out of the business of actually being the shipping, the person who you buy your card from, and then they collect the money from you. They just want to be the collector. And so you will use different things, which I think a lot of people do. If you never have like your card where you can swipe for your gas and things like that, it's something similar to that, where you will swipe your card for your Metro fare, or you can even use like your iPhone they were talking about. I don't know how you would do that, but they said you could.
Okay.
No, I was going to say they haven't mastered. I slowed that talk. Sorry. They haven't mastered the smart trip card yet. And I think they're going a little too fast, because once you have to master one thing before you move on to something else. And of course, I had a lot of problems. Thank heavens for John. He helped me get through it. But I lost a lot of money because they haven't, mastered everything yet. And then I think what's not happening is if you lose $10 or $5, the bus driver is supposed to fill out that form. And you're supposed to get your money within 72 hours. But that's not happening. So I think before they start talking about a whole new fare system, they should master the smart.
I think what they were saying, to your point, Ms. Daniels, is that it would be better at this than I was. But this instead of taking your money, adding it to a card, it will be on your card. And so the way I understand it could help prevent the loss of money, because instead of adding money to your Metro card, you will just have it on your card. Now they are very sensitive. One thing that I thought was very important that they raised is being sensitive to the unbanked population, the people in the city and in the surrounding areas who may not have all these other fare medias, and how to get them to have be able to use the system. But also, this is going to be the next phase of smart card, because we know smart card can't go on forever. We don't have the chip anymore and things like that. It's going to be the next phase of what Metro does in order to serve the public. But you're right. I don't think they have it perfectly down yet either. But I think that this is the next phase. And it's also, from what I understand, in their very early stages. Like, it's not going to happen this year.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Okay, we'll move on to the Governance Committee, and I'll report back from that. We had created and called a Governance Committee meeting to have a discussion about what the role of the RAC is, and or we should say what the roles of the RAC are. We noted that there were multiple roles. And also, as part of that, what our relationship to other entities in Metro are, Metro staff, Metro board, other riders. And so it's a somewhat philosophical discussion, but it has practical applications and practical implications for things like requesting information from Metro staff or addressing the board or different relationships that we have. Again, we're at the initial stage of discussion, and we invite you to our next meeting, which will be posted on email.
Last time we sent a letter to the Maryland State. Last time we sent a letter to the Maryland State Legislature on their proposal that would incorporate some of our suggestions and ignore some of our suggestions. Did we get a reaction to that? Any response at all?
I don't feel pleased to come.
Are you talking? You're talking about the choosing Maryland board members and such.
Proposed legislation that would incorporate some of the things.
Yeah, let me, actually, let me.
I was just curious, any response or reaction to what we...
Yes. If you all recall, we sent a letter to one of the committees in the Maryland Senate that we're looking at legislation that would change how criteria for how Metro appoints board members. There actually was, I got a call from a staff member to, I think, Senator Rosa Pepe.
Yes.
One of the legislators from, I think, Maryland County. Thank you, Prince George's County. And they actually did make the changes. They made a lot of the changes that the RAC and some other folks had suggested. I think the Coalition for Smarter Growth testified. I think some other folks testified. Penny can add if I missed anybody. However, that bill, at the end of the legislative session, there was crossover from one house to the other. And this bill didn't make it out of the Senate to cross over the House, so essentially it's dead for this year. So the RAC's recommendations were noted by a group of Maryland senators, and they did submit those sort of legislative changes, but then the whole thing didn't go anywhere.
Okay, so we won the battle and lost the war.
All right, pretty much.
Thank you.
Okay, Public Safety Task Force, Victoria and Joseph.
John, Joseph, and I met with Deputy Chief Padlick where we had a teleconference to discuss holding a public meeting. We're thinking right now the public meeting will probably be sometime in May. We want to plan to have 200 people. But we want to invite the public's input on ways that we want to develop the public to develop a better relationship with transit police. So we don't want to turn to a meeting and just complaining, but Joseph and I met earlier today and we're talking about how to structure the meeting. We would like transit police to do a short presentation, and then we'd like to do one from the RAC with some of our ideas for that transit police could possibly implement. But a couple of things that he said on the phone were interesting. They are planning to, I think by the end of June, to have all the signs up with their phone numbers in every station, on the pylons, in the entrances. And I think they have a meeting scheduled with all the local jurisdictions too. Did they already have that, John?
I can't remember when it was, but it was soon. They are meeting with all the regional, you know, D.C. Metropolitan Police and Montgomery County and
Prince. All the chiefs are meeting to also work on their relationship. So we'd like him to report on that and other things. And also just to explain exactly why we don't see them, you know, how thin they are spread throughout the entire system. I don't think people really understand. But if you have any suggestions for the RACS part of the public meeting, let us know. We'll add it to our presentation.
Thank you. Deborah?
I have a question for you for trying. Do we have a website on RAC yet?
We have a spot on the Metro website.
Okay.
Which tab is that under, John, if you're on the homepage?
About Metro.
About Metro. It's like the tab on the far right at the top. Once you're inside the page, it will be on the left side. The left sidebar, you'll see a link to it once you're past the
homepage. Chris?
Before, just today, I heard, I think for the first time on a train, I guess it was on Green, and it was about an announcement saying to enforce the no eating policy on Metro, saying that they were both uniform and plainclothes persons enforcing. I wonder if that was just, it's just beginning to be announced, or is that going to be?
I'll let that to our list to get an update.
Yeah, we didn't talk about that.
No. My only suggestion is that Metro actually does have a special police, and they do things like provide security in this building, and bus garages and other Metro facilities. Given the budget difficulty, and given how expensive and how long it takes to, even if you decide to have the funding to get an extra Metro police officer, I'm wondering. One of the options they should consider is, for example, deploying the special police as a supplement in parking lots to patrol them, because there just aren't enough officers, and there never will be. And other agencies like Los Angeles, Metropolitan Education Authority, use a combination of uniform law enforcement and private contract security guards, who would be, by the way, supervised by the Metro Police as part of the existing special police.
That was mentioned on our phone call. It was right after. I guess she came on to present to the board, but they mentioned coming up with an auxiliary police force.
Those are volunteers.
Right, right. But we're going to ask him to elaborate on that, but I can also bring him here again, too.
And not only, well, he did talk about the patrolling of the office, which is why he's meeting with the regional chief, which is, I mean, basically, you know, if you're, I would be Shelby, because it's a meditation I use often, but if you're the Shelby police officer who's parked on the corner of the Shelby Metro Station, patrolling the streets, asking them to drive through the Metro Park parking lot to patrol the parking lot as you do your regular patrol over in your area. And so that's something that they haven't done in the past, that they want to try to get to do more. We didn't ask them about the special police, and we probably can't. I can probably tell you, just probably know what his response will probably be, is that if, because it's so different, the jurisdictions are different, and there might be a problem with special police officers being able to operate in Maryland and in Virginia because of those laws. I'm not exactly sure, but I do know that Maryland has different security laws than D.C. Maryland has stricter ones, and so you have to be more certified than you would be in D.C. I don't know if that's an excuse for staff, but that might be one of the reasons.
Well,
just
one more thing. I think Joseph brought up someone mentioned why is there not a standard number like 311 to call the police. And he was saying that they've tried to do this within the jurisdictions, but the different jurisdictions can't agree on one number. So that's why the problem, you don't call. If you call 911 now, it might have to get transferred over, you know. But I think they're bringing that up again when they meet with the jurisdictions.
It's like a lot of regional cooperation that never happened before, that they are trying to start.
Carl and then Deborah, and then I think we'll bring this to a close.
To that point, I think at this proposed meeting or into the future, it would be interesting to also have present representatives from the major police forces outside of the metro. Obviously, there are a lot of smaller jurisdictions that provide coverage in metro territory, but I do think a discussion would be aided by the presence of, you know, someone from MPD, perhaps someone from the second and third biggest, you know, jurisdictional police forces. Just a thought for the future.
Deborah?
I want to add to the question. Maybe you want to include information. I don't know if I was aware of it, but include information about the audio answer.
Okay.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Victoria and Joseph. This is an exciting, I think an exciting and new venture for the RAC to have an activity like this, and appreciate your work. And I would just encourage all of the members, if you have further input that you would like to give them, to contact them by email, and so that it will help with their planning. So thank you very much. We now have two agenda items left and 10 minutes to do them. So I think I'm going to dispense with item number 9 because the person who brought that up, Carol Walker, is not here tonight. and I really would like her to have some input on this. We deferred this item from last month's meeting, and when I apologized to Carol for doing that, she said, I really would like to have the discussion, but there's no sense of urgency to it. So I think I would really like her to have the opportunity to be here. So we'll dispense with that item of the agenda and move to open mic for 10 minutes. An open mic is our period where it's a free-for-all. If you want to recite poetry or sing a song. Just a few things up. Pat, Kelsey, and Carl.
Okay, my question is, a moving of a bus stop. I failed to ask John, and somehow I think Ms. Cousins mentioned it, but she didn't give me enough information. A friend of mine said they had construction, but once the construction was done, they never put the bus out back. So what way do you have of getting the bus out back? Do you have to do like a petition with million people? Or just a small group will be able to put it back? I mean, you know, can you sort of give me an idea?
I don't know. I will follow up. I'll put this on my list of things to follow up on from the meeting. I would imagine that if there's a bus stop there to begin with, and it's not establishing a new bus stop, if it's just a matter of putting the sign back up, then all they have to, you know, all somebody has to do is bring it to their attention, and they put the sign back up. You know, I think, at least to my eyes, and I'll ask the professionals.
Okay.
But reinstalling a sign is not a policy decision. It's reinstalling a sign that somebody took down.
Oh.
Whereas removing a bus stop or establishing a new bus stop seems to meet a different threshold. But I'll check with our bus stop folks to see if they know better. And if you have a specific location, route, direction, intersection, etc.,
okay,
we can talk about that offline.
Yeah, I'll call you.
Okay. Or talk to me after this.
Thank you. Sure. Katie and I had some discussion about this over email, and that is, at least for the bus committee, since we have so many new board members and even new RAC members, perhaps putting together a fact sheet, just a one-pager or two-pager, that summarizes, in our case, what the bus committee has discussed, what we've accomplished over the last 3 years, so that this way the new board members we have and even the existing board members can kind of know what the RAC has already discussed, where we've been, and where we really need to go in the future. And I think they will probably find that some of our requests for our demands that have been quite redundant. So I guess I'm putting this out there because I would like more information from everyone, and maybe Penny too, to get your thoughts on this. Is this a good idea? Is it a bad idea? How do we get it and keep it manageable? How do we make it most useful for those new board members, for the entire board, should we decide to give them a one-pager or a two-pager on what the bus committee has done in the past?
Great suggestion. I'm going to bypass your call because I think, Dawn, do you want to respond to that? Diane, do you want to respond to that? Or?
Kind of. I guess this kind of echoes something that I think Carl put in an email and a realization I've had based on some conversations I've had with various folks outside of this group who know that I'm in this role, which is, you know, I think that we've done a lot of work over the past few years, and it seems like when I mention to people that I have this commitment or I'm just talking about what they think about WMATA, they tend to bring up issues that I think we've talked about with WMATA staff a lot in the past. And I feel like we've done a lot of work, and I think that on some level we need to be better, or we need to kind of go back a little bit and kind of catalog what we've discussed with people and try and follow up on some of these things somehow. And I mean, I think we have to do this in the context of, we are an advisory group, right? We're not WMATA management, we're not the board. But, you know, I think there are certain themes or certain sort of tough issues that kind of keep coming up, and we kind of keep on them. But, you know, not always, not that we're necessarily approaching it all the time like it's a new issue, but just kind of to remind ourselves that some of these things are not new issues, you know, and they are things that we've seen presentations of before, and we've discussed with people before, and, you know, kind of just develop an appreciation for our own capacity that would maybe help us kind of start to focus our efforts maybe in a way that could maximize our effectiveness, if that's not too, like,
buzzwordy.
And I do have something else that I
wanted
to mention, but I just
thought I'd put
out there.
Oh, thank you. That's great. I agree with Diana. Also, I think I and other members of the council would appreciate an update at the next meeting from Metro Capital Planning / Government Relations. A lot of writers that I've spoken to recently have expressed concern about with the current status of the federal government on if that capital money that is part of the agreement between the jurisdictions and the federal government will be coming through. I think a lot of people are probably going to be curious on what the plans are to either fill that gap or move forward and with luck, within a month, we'll know what the status of that money is. And, you know, I think a lot of people are very worried because that is a big chunk of the capital budget moving forward. And it represents a very large loss for the agency. So I would request that just a short update. There doesn't need to be a discussion or a presentation, but an update from someone on staff about the status of that. And, you know, if it doesn't come through in the House CR, will the jurisdictions be contributing, that sort of thing? Thank you. Ron?
I actually wanted to touch on that. And I think also as a RAC, if it does come through, I think a update of paper would be sufficient. If it doesn't, then I think we need a presence at the meeting. Also, as a RAC, I think we need to be prepared to discuss what the consequences of losing that money is. Because then, in order to get the capital, to stretch your capital dollars, cutting off service after midnight, for example, on Fridays and Saturdays, doesn't become so much an operating budget issue as it is. We've got very limited capital. We have a longer closure. We can then work more frequently. And as a RAC, we have to be willing to weigh in on those. And things like, you know, there are these performance standards that Mr. Charles has held to, and, you know, I'm assuming that they improve. And without that $300 million a year, not only are they not going to improve, they're probably going to get worse. And we need to be willing to weigh in on, you know, what our priorities are. So I just think teeing that up is something we need to be prepared to discuss in a worst-case scenario where the $150 million doesn't come through this year. And if that happens, likely may not come through the following year. We need to be prepared for the consequences of that, as dire as they may be.
Yeah. Have Joseph, Diana, Victoria, and then I think we're going to need to end.
Diana, and Kelsey. We're speaking about the list of, I guess, accomplishments. I think we talked about this in the governance committee. When someone recommended we do the same thing as well, to send to the board as well. And I'm not exactly sure what happened with that discussion right there. I think I left the other room. But when I left the other room, the discussion was going in a positive direction. We were moving away from doing I think that John, I don't mean throwing it under the bus, but I think John had mentioned that it might be we might be unable to tangibly link what we talked about to and what became the reality to what to our success to because we talked about it. And so,
That's right. But I think a little different. A little different coming from Kelsey and Dana is, you know, what has the RAC recommended, and maybe not necessarily assigning, you know, the RAC said this, and so 40% of the reason why X happened is because the RAC said so, but a little differently is, well, we suggested this and sort of what's happened with it, and it would be a good review. You know, I mean, the RAC's been around for, we're going on 6 years now, and it's talked about a lot of stuff, and I think it would be a good review to, for everybody involved to sort of know what's been covered and what hasn't, and everything
else. Between accomplishments and influence, I think, you know, and
right.
You can make accomplishments without boasting influence, because the influence is harder to gauge. Diana?
Okay, well, first, just an addendum to my earlier remarks. This wasn't intended to be some sort of, I wasn't talking so much about a list of what we did or what we said and where we did, like, accomplish something and push something. It was more like, what have we talked about in the past? It was more like, I think the foil to that is, where have we talked about things, where have we raised issues, and where something not happened? Because what I'm starting to see now that I've been with this group for a while is that, you know, people who are new to the area, who are maybe new to riding transit in the area, are bringing up things that have been raised in the past, in some cases even before I was involved in the RIC, as if, you know, because to them it is new, and it's not new, it's an issue that's been discussed in the past, and I think that history can sometimes be useful when you're trying to influence decision makers. Mm-hmm. You know, do you remember the letters from 2006 and 2007 on this issue, and it's coming up again, and you know, it seems to have died for a while, but not because it really went away, but because people thought something was happening, but nothing did, and now we've still got the same problem. So it's more kind of like, how can we be most effective in terms of addressing issues that are still kind of with WMATA? I think was kind of more, I think where I was kind of coming from, I kind of sense that was maybe where Kelsey was coming from as well.
Yeah, looking for feedback, I'm still trying to figure out my mind how it was best.
Right. Okay. But the other thing I just wanted to raise, sort of in the context of open mic, is something went by recently, I think, in the Express about the new line that would be coming in from Dulles, and there's now a proposal to not only sort of have it as like an extension of the orange line, but it's now going to go all the way into D.C. through Rosslyn, and there would be a series of new stations in D.C. that would sort of run north of the orange and blue line stations. I just wanted to put it out there. It's something that went by really briefly. I'm not really clear where it is in the context of the broader organization, but you know, I just wanted to put, I don't know if anybody else had seen anything on it or knew anything about it, but it seemed like a pretty big step and a step up from what I heard the past proposal on the project. So just as a sort of putting it out there.
Thanks. Your last word.
I would like clarification on when RAC members are invited to speak somewhere. RAC members are invited to speak at a panel.
Uh-huh.
If they're speaking as themselves, or if they're invited as a member of the RAC, they need some guidance. If they're speaking for the RAC, I guess we need to know what they're saying. They need to make sure they're actually speaking for us.
Well, I think when people are invited to speak as members of the RAC, they should speak as members of the RAC. But do you want us to look into that more, or do you?
I think we need some formal guidance, and that people should mention, by the way, I'm going to speak on this panel next month or whenever, speaking for the RAC. It's nice to know.
I agree. What I think what has happened in the past is that usually the invitations come after a RAC meeting, so they become post-fact things. You know, we report we did speak at the, you know, did speak at this rather than we're going to speak at this. But I think that's a good point, that if we do know in advance, we should let folks know.
Yeah, I guess I just want people to be mindful. If you're invited as, you know, a RAC member, then keep in mind, mm-hmm. you aren't sure what you're saying is speaking for the RAC.
Right.
Make sure you're saying something that's your personal opinion.
Right. I got a call yesterday, I'll tell you, from the PG Sentinel, the Prince George County Sentinel, at the Metro, what is it called? Metro Act.
Metro,
yes.
National Metro Safety Act
National
or something?
Metro Act. And
some kind of legislation that's working its way through Congress.
When I got to the reporter, he was asking me questions, and I said, let me tell you, I am not, do you want me to speak as the RAC chair, or do you want me to speak as a writer? I said, which of me are you addressing? He said, because the RAC has not taken a policy on this, so I really could not tell you much. And so he said, well, then speak to me as a writer. So I felt more at liberty to give opinion as a writer, but I really clarified that I was not speaking as the RAC chair at that moment. Okay, the meeting is adjourned.